From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Neiman Marcus is just the latest American company to file for bankruptcy, as the Labor Department reported today that another 3.2 million Americans filed for unemployment last week.
That brings the total of jobless claims related to the pandemic to over 33 million. For more, let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Ali, it's just millions more, week after week. How long is this expected to go on?
Well, if you want to look on the bright side, the numbers have been coming down. I mean, these are, historically unforeseen numbers to have this many people in a month. You can go back to when we started keeping these numbers in 1948, and you've never seen anything like it. That said, they are going down. So when we were at the 6 million plus per week, there was some fear that that's all the state computer programs could handle and that it was going to be more than that. We are seeing them coming down. The question is, if you are adding half a million or a million even on a weekly basis, that means your unemployment number is nowhere close to settling. So when we get that brand new number tomorrow, which is going to be a big shock to the system, that's the monthly unemployment number for the month of April. We know that that's going to continue to go higher.
Well, and the question is, how temporary is this, and will these jobs come back? Uber yesterday laid off 14% of its worldwide staff. A day earlier, Airbnb cut 25%. Do you see these jobs coming back?
You know, it's going to be difficult because half of this is the stay-at-home orders and the spread of the infection, and half of it is psychology, right? This is a consumer-driven society. On one hand, one thing we're not seeing is an increase in public transportation. So people are driving more, but they're not getting into public transportation. So is Uber and things like that this halfway? Will people go to movie theaters? Will they go to malls? Will they go to sporting events? Will they get on airplanes? So we're not sure how people will behave. And for companies, they, in many cases, for their planning, for their buying and things like that, they have to plan a couple of quarters in advance. And what companies don't have is visibility into what is opening up look like. Is school going back into session? And will people shop again? They certainly can't predict to the last quarter of this year, but we can't even predict to the third quarter of this year. So I think for the time being, you will see more layoffs, not fewer. What we don't know is the first part of your question. What does a snapback look like? Certainly some parts of the economy will come back immediately, but we know that airplanes are capping the amount of people who'll be on the planes. We know that restaurants will have to leave space between people. So you're not going to see a complete snapback. The question is, how long before we get back to normal? What does normal even look like? And are we looking at a year, 2 years, or 5 years? And that's the great unknown.
And we're already seeing some of the effects of this, including people lining up at food banks around the country. Now, according to the Brookings Institution, one-fifth of young children are not getting enough to eat in America, according to their mothers. That's three times worse than was the case in the financial crisis in 2008. What are the concerns when it comes to hunger in America?
Well, let me just give you some numbers here. In addition to the ones that you've given me, there were, before coronavirus hit, 40 million people who are what you describe as food insecure in America, which means they don't stock enough food for the next day. Those might be people going to food banks. They may be people who are earning money on a daily basis, on a cash basis. So that was 40 million people out of 328 million people in the population. That's probably going to increase. And this continues to be a big concern because a lot of students got their meals at schools. Now, a lot of schools continue to serve meals sort of as a food bank even after school closed, but we don't know how that long that will continue for, and a lot of people don't go out to get it. So hunger in this country was a problem before coronavirus. It's now exacerbated, and children who are hungry, even if they're schooling at home, cannot get the education. We have scientific proof of that. So I think this is going to become something that is going to have to be a priority in terms of solving for people who are food insecure and hungry in America, especially children.
Well, and it's something Democrats are already talking about as they look forward to what could be another emergency relief package from Congress. What do we know about what might be in that and if something like that is forthcoming?
Yeah, so there are three things we're looking for. Emergency aid, including food aid and aid to people who don't get it. There are still people in America, because of the type of businesses they run or the type of jobs they hold, that didn't qualify for the rebate checks or the unemployment. A lot of people just don't work in businesses that do that. So we're going to be trying to look for the people who slipped through the cracks. We're going to be trying to look at things that can structurally change that aren't just on an emergency basis, like health care, like Medicare extensions, like people who are having to go back to work and getting sick, protections for those workers, for the meat plants. And we're seeing this with Amazon workers. But we're bumping up against ideology here with a number of people saying, you know what, the more you pay people not to work, the less likely they are to go to work. And that is a debate that's been going on for 250 years and is going to continue.
That is Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Ali, thank you.
My pleasure.
So there's lots of economic pain to go around and grief. Both can be isolating, but never more so than in the middle of a pandemic, which is keeping loved ones physically distant. Nina Feldman from member station WHYY in Philadelphia reports on one family's struggle to say a proper goodbye.
When Donald Spitko went to the hospital for shortness of breath, no one in his family imagined it would be the last time they saw him. Not his wife of nearly 60 years, not his six kids. He was placed on a ventilator right away, and the hospital had a strict no-visitors policy. It even applied to his two daughters, who worked there.
We were trying everything to go see my dad. I mean, honestly, we were beating down doors.
That's Tammy King. She's a nurse at Einstein Medical Center in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, where her dad was receiving care.
I chose to test myself because I thought if I showed him that I was negative, I would be able to at least go to his window and see him through the glass. And they won't even let me through the ICU.
Einstein's administrators said the policy is designed to keep staff, patients, and guests safe. But it didn't seem fair. King and her sister, Michelle Rocco, had the same access to protective gear as the nurses caring for their dad.
I work on the same floor as my dad was on, and I could not walk down the same hallway because my dad was down that hallway. It was hard. It was horrible. I went to work as much as it hurt me, but
And funny, I went to work because I felt closer to him.
Yeah.
The sisters were able to keep close tabs on their dad by talking to their colleagues who were caring for him. The whole family video chatted with him every day. But after a few weeks, it just didn't seem like he was getting any better.
We never gave up hope until we kind of knew one day, just by the look on my dad's face, that it started turning empty. It's the only way I can describe it. It was an emptiness.
So after 25 days, they made the decision to take him off the ventilator. The nurse caring for their father said once the tube was removed, they'd likely have about 10 minutes before Spitko stopped breathing on his own. The family gathered around an iPad and said their goodbyes. King struggled with these final moments.
You couldn't go up to him and kiss him goodbye. You couldn't touch his hand. It's just, it was a very impersonal. Yeah. When you're talking to an iPad, it just really stinks.
Yeah.
This virus, it really does.
Her sister, Rocco, says she was just grateful for the time they did have.
I saw more of him yesterday than I would have if we were in the hospital taking turns.
The family waited. An hour passed, then another. They started telling stories about who he was, beyond just an 81-year-old man with COVID-19.
He would be one of those people that if your car broke down on your tire, he would get out, and no matter what time it was, and help him get, you know, fixed or whatever.
Donald J. Spitko was a proud veteran. He loved to camp and hunt and go on long road trips with his daughters. He was the easygoing one of the parents.
He would let us do anything. My mom worked night shifts because we had six kids in our family. So every time she left for work, my dad would say, if you sneak out of the house, just make sure you get home.
After 7 virtual hours with his family, as the battery on the hospital's iPad was getting ready to die, Donald Spitko took his last breath. The next day, the sisters organized a funeral procession for their father.
I'm in the parking lot at Einstein Medical in Montgomery County. It's rainy. There are about 20 or so cars, and we're driving to the funeral parlor.
In the parking lot of the funeral home, family and friends got out of their cars and hovered, not sure what to do. They couldn't hug, and because everyone was wearing face masks, it was hard to tell how people were really feeling. Some of the family lined up next to a large flag with Marine insignia as the remaining cars trickled in. And then that was it. There was no viewing, no ceremony.
You don't think it'll happen to you or your family. You think, like, you know, you're untouchable until something this fast can come upon you. It's just not right. It's backwards.
The night after her father died, Tammy King went to work at the hospital. While she was there, she got a call from the nurse who'd sat with him. She said she had something to give her.
She made for each family member his fingerprints in the shape of a heart with a heart drawn around it. And it said Donald Spicko, then the year he was born, then the year he passed.
The nurse caring for her father happened to also be named Tammy. King says she hopes it was of some comfort to her father to hear that name spoken by his side, since she couldn't be there herself.
For Here and Now, I'm Nina Feldman.
And if you've lost a loved one to COVID-19, NPR wants to remember them, starting with essential workers like grocery store clerks, mail carriers, healthcare workers. We'd like to hear their story through you. Please go to npr.org/frontlineworkers, all one word, to share your memory. So how's this whole stay-at-home thing going? We hear a lot about parents having to craft whole new relationships with their kids, but how about with each other? Is this a chance to take up couples decoupage together? Or have pressures from unemployment and close quarters revealed loose planks in your carefully constructed relationship through which you are falling? Well, hold on. Renowned international couples therapist Esther Perel is here, the Belgian-born best-selling author and host of the insanely popular podcast series Where Should We Begin, has now added a four-part YouTube series and a new podcast, Couples Under Lockdown. These aren't patients, but people who volunteer beg for an anonymous session with her, and we listen in. We'll link you to our past conversation about life after adultery, but today, is there life after lockdown, with Esther Perel, who joins us by Skype from New York. And Esther, you say a crisis like this one is a relationship accelerator. Start there.
We're living with a sense of mortality that is hovering over us, not just in terms of the physical lives, but the loss of the worlds that we have known. And when you feel that life is short, you kind of say, what am I waiting for? And it throws the superfluous overboard. And you say, let's have babies. Let's be together. Let's get married. Or you say, life is short. I've been waiting long enough. And then you say, open the door and let me out of here. We've always said more divorces, more babies in pandemics, in disaster periods. And this is one of those.
Your first podcast reminds us that stay at home, you know, is probably revealing or making more painful infidelities. It's about a couple in New York City. They filed for divorce right before the pandemic. The wife grieving the marriage, the husband wants to be with his girlfriend. Tensions are high. Let's listen to the wife.
Like 2 weeks ago, I had to get a pediatrician, child therapist, everybody to explain to him why seeing his girlfriend during COVID was not appropriate or safe for the girls.
Ugh. Esther, this is extreme. But how do you stop yourself from saying to a guy who wants to see his girlfriend in the middle of a pandemic, don't be a jerk?
I actually said it slightly different. I assumed the man is a smart man who knows what is right. So I say to him, if you could, you would want to see her. That's a given. I get that. This is about duty rather than desire. And I respect that. That's what I say to him in a nutshell, you know.
So you're a better person than most.
It's a both and, you know. I mean, the wife tells him you're a jerk. I'm not there to say that. What I know is that he understands that he has three daughters at home. And in this moment, it is probably wise to be there with them. But I can give him both so that he doesn't have to counter me by keeping the other side secret. I've made it explicit. We know that if you could, this is where you would be. And we know that you've decided to act differently.
There's a couple you counsel in Germany. They've lived apart for work for the last year. Now they're suddenly forced together, can't even leave the house, not sure of where they want to go. You call out the couple. Here you are counseling the wife.
I think that on some level, you know that you acted in a way that was hurtful to him. And you're scared that you're going to lose him. because there's a part of you that thinks, I didn't act right. But then when he actually does tell you how much he cares, you're so convinced now that he doesn't anymore that you don't even hear it.
This seems so, probably will be familiar to people. Their goal is the same. Mm. They want to be in love, but they are talking past each other.
Right, right. So the couple's under lockdown. I'm literally, through Zoom, entering their homes, their closets. In the Sicilian case, they literally had to be in a closet in order to be have some space away from their three young children. And it has a level of intimacy and revelation. This couple, he feeling abandoned that she went to Germany to this for this dream job, and she feeling abandoned that he didn't follow. And lo and behold, it's the virus that makes the decision for them. He appeared at her house in Germany. And in fact, they are really getting along a lot better. But when you have hurt someone, you want to be forgiven, but there's a part of you that doesn't know if you deserve it. And so you enter into this position that says, you know, reassure me, but I don't believe you. But make me believe you because I really want to. And when he says to her, you know, I wanted to cook for you. And he's actually saying, I care. I want to be with you. She hears him say to her, what you did was wrong. And that's the adjustment that needs to be made in that moment, is listen to what is being said rather than listen for the confirmation of your assumption. In the midst of crisis, couples will often go to periods of destruction and then a repair. And this reconnection demands trust, vulnerable to what the other person is inviting, rather than defending yourself, expecting the worst, like a confirmation bias. And it's a very common thing. But what happens is that because they're in lockdown, everything is intensified. The couples who really get strengthened here are able to continuously say, I'm so appreciative that I'm going through this with you. And it's your personality that makes me feel safe, looked after, not alone, and stronger when they are confined and basically separated from many of the other resources of support that they usually turn to.
Yeah. Or the ability to just walk out the door and occupy themselves with something else.
Yes. Many. A couple has a rhythm. That means that you leave, you go to work, you go to see friends. This is what is missing at this moment.
I have to ask you about the couple in Italy. It broke my heart in some places. You tease out from the woman who's a nurse who's treating COVID patients that she is holding on to anger at her husband, who's staying at home taking care of the kids during a lockdown. She sees in him a father who wasn't kind. He feels like he can't do anything right. You nudge them along. Let's listen.
What's the one thing that you've been wanting to say to her?
The one thing that I want to say to you, I miss you. Yeah, I miss you. I miss you. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I can't just say I miss you and then you come back suddenly. But I miss you. And I want you. I want to be with you.
In silence, because she's just, it doesn't seem ready. But, you know, you say something else, Esther, in this that it made me sit up. You say to this couple, your kids are watching you. They learn their relational code from you. And that's happening under lockdown more than ever. What do you mean by that?
Let me put it this way. Sometimes when couples come to my office, I learned this from my dear colleague, Hedy Schleifer. I ask people to bring pictures of their children. And I just say, here are your kids. They're watching you. Everything you're doing to each other is what they are learning. This idea that, you know, you have a responsibility beyond yourself about this is very humbling to people. Because when you fight, you often feel deserving, you feel entitled, you feel justified, you know, you're not humble necessarily. So the presence of your children who are watching you humbles you. You know, there's a concept called invisible divorce from Megan Fleming. And this couple, in a way, was living with that. They were separated, disconnected inside their own families. COVID changes the balance of interdependence between them. They're in a small flat. It's Sicily. It's in the middle of the epicenter of that moment. And death is hovering all around, and you then begin to deal with the symbolic deaths that have taken place in your relationship. And now you have to decide, is it just going to disappear, or are we going to fight to reconnect with each other? Because it is that connection, that sense of aliveness, that erotic force that is going to be the antidote to death.
Yeah. Esther Perel, for the couple that's just annoyed with each other or, you know, finding it hard, just some tips.
For me, kindness will go a long way. Try to look at what people are doing that is nice, that is kind, that you can comment upon, that you can be appreciative of, rather than going around with a flashlight for the wrong, for the missing, for the criticisms. When you want something, ask for it rather than making a critique about what the other person hasn't done. Make a request rather than a protest. If you can, when you talk about something that you disagree with, keep it to one thing and don't start kitchen sinking and pour all the issues into the same bucket, and including the ones from 5 years ago. It's so easy to complain about how the other person is dealing with it. You're going out, you went to the park. This constant negotiation, which is very much normal and in the nature of the beast, also creates enormous empathic distress, moments of complete fragmentation where people, instead of turning toward each other, are turning against each other. Those things will help. Put your hands on each other, give each other a hug, because there's nothing more to say. It's just let the body speak. Because when you talk, you go all rational and statistics. And when you hold, you are so tender and caring. And we are at this moment very touch hungry, that physical reassuring hand that grounds us rather than let people just yak away. Allow yourself to celebrate. Allow yourself to experience pleasure. Allow yourself to be intimate sexually. You know, we are still alive, those of us who are, to close ourselves off of any of the things that actually will ground us, will make us feel safe, is actually a disadvantage rather than a resource.
Mm. Esther Perel. Esther, thank you as always.
It's a pleasure talking to you.
And we will link you to everything, including Esther's new YouTube series. It starts with Loneliness Under Lockdown. And, of course, the podcast, Couples Under Lockdown. Everything at hereandnow.org.
We've been hearing about the thousands of workers at meatpacking plants across the country being infected with the coronavirus. President Trump has said plants must stay open even as the case numbers rise. Corinne Boyer of the Kansas News Service talked with workers at plants in Dodge City, Kansas, about their safety concerns.
Dodge City is home to two meatpacking plants, National Beef and Cargill. On a Tuesday afternoon, dozens of cars and semi-trucks streamed down the roads near the plants. It was time for a shift change. Workers pulled into the parking lots as people walked out of the plants. Everyone was wearing face masks, and some wore hard hats. Showing up every day at National Beef during the COVID-19 pandemic scares worker Brandon Vasquez.
As soon as I start parking, I'm just like, my heart starts beating fast. And like, I have high blood pressure. So like, I'm getting anxiety right away as soon as I'm walking towards the plant. And then once I'm in there, I mean, it's hard to perform good and do the job right.
As of May 6th, 985 Kansas meatpacking workers have COVID-19, and two people have died. In southwest Kansas, there are cases at all four meatpacking plants. The rural counties where the plants are located quickly outpace the state's most populous areas.
I just want a two-week shutdown just to do some more modifications on top of what they did.
Lupe Rodriguez also works at National Beef. She's been staying home without pay because she's concerned about catching the virus and because she has a young son that can't go to daycare.
When the daycare found out about the positives inside the plant, she didn't want to expose any of the other kids if I was exposed.
Both Rodriguez and Vasquez say precautions should have been taken sooner. Every plant has a few thousand workers who stand side by side in many cases to kill, skin, cut, and package meat. Temperature checks at National Beef didn't begin until April, after non-essential Kansans were ordered by the state to stay at home. COVID-19 information was provided in English and Spanish at National Beef, but not in languages spoken by refugees and immigrants from Guatemala, Somalia, and Southeast Asia who work in the plants. Lucia Rangel works at the Cargill plant in Dodge City. She says Cargill cleans multiple times a day. They've been disinfecting the bathrooms, the doors, anywhere that can get contaminated, she said. Rangel says she's more worried about leaving work. When people go out to shop and run errands, she says she doesn't know who is sick and who isn't. Regardless of how many workers become infected, packing plants must remain open under an April 28th order from President Donald Trump. Not long after, Kansas Governor Laura Kelly addressed why none of Kansas's plants have closed.
We were one of the only states where we didn't have to shut down a packing plant because we already had the systems in place to be able to work safely.
For several weeks, the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, which represents meatpacking workers, has pressured Kelly to designate them as temporary first responders. That would help get more personal protective equipment to workers. Brandon Vasquez is in the union and says it's not possible for him to social distance from others while he's working.
I mean, a lot of people are getting tested right now. Our numbers are going to get higher. And I just worried about the state opening up again, and it just going to get higher and higher. And I don't know. It's a tough situation.
And as Kansas begins to reopen, coronavirus cases in counties with meatpacking plants continue to climb. For Here and Now, I'm Corinne Boyer in Dodge City.
Have you been exploring your creative side in isolation? Maybe recreating museum masterpieces while using hoarded toilet paper. Oops, too bad. Someone got there first. Francesco Di Grazio recreated Caravaggio's Boy with a Basket of Fruit, only instead of fruit, he's holding rolls of toilet paper. And it all started with Ana Luz Offizier's rendition of Vermeer's Girl with a Pearl Earring on the Instagram site now called Tusen Kutz in Quarantaine, Art and Kitsch in Quarantine in Dutch. It has thousands of takes on masterpieces side by side with recreations made from household items, 261,000 followers, and Ana Luz Offizier joins us now. Ana Luz, how did this start?
It started when I got a message from my office to go work at home for a couple of weeks as there got more news outside of the coronavirus. And my housemate also had to stay at home to work. We had one day together and she said, okay, how can we make this more light, fun? She asked it in our friend's WhatsApp group and I responded with this. It wasn't even a challenge when I posted it, of course. I just mentioned, let's recreate a painting with stuff you find lying around the house because you're in the house all day. And then I made the example of the girl with the pearl earring. And people, my friends were laughing about it because it was, of course, not a great pick, but so recognizable. And then I said, okay, well, if you guys like this and you need also something to take your mind off, please send them to me and we can laugh about each other like that. Mm. And I got a few really great ones. One from a friend who's in Australia. She did Frida Kahlo. I think Frida is really popular.
Yeah.
Especially in from like Argentina, Brazil. I get a lot of Frida Kahlos. So that's really funny. Then the Rijksmuseum. It's the, I think, the most famous museum in the Netherlands. They started to follow me on my personal account, which has like holiday pics and stuff like that. So then we thought, okay, maybe I should open up a public account.
Well, and you said you would never have named it Tusen Kutz in Quarantaine after a popular TV show.
Yeah, it's like when people find like hidden gems in their home, like a painting or something from an old box, and they take it there and they will tell you if it's worth like a million or it's just something from the flea market.
We have that too. We have a show like that too. But you say you never would have picked that name if you ever thought this was going to go global, because it's just, it's for some people hard to say. But, you know, we'll have some of the pictures at hereandnow.org. They're amazing. I mean, people holding mops to, you know, instead of a lance.
Those are my favorites.
That's your favorite?
Yeah, when people use like an household item, which is like something everyone has lying around, instead of what's in the original. That's the thing I like the most about recreations.
People seem to, there's humor here, but the poses they strike and the faces, some of them are taking it seriously.
So serious. I love it the most when people use the items, but also when they mimic the original so well. I like that people are taking the time to
imitated so perfectly.
Right. It's serious business. What are you going to do with this? You can't stop it. You've got, what, you've had 24,000 contributions. What do you plan on doing with this?
Some people say a traveling exhibition or exposition. That would be awesome. Mm. I'm not sure by when we're going to do stuff like that, but it would be lovely to arrange something so people can see their art in museum and just celebrate that the life is getting back to normal, whatever new normal may be, of course.
Yeah.
And other people are asking if we want to make a book out of it, which I think is really funny because it's not all beautiful pictures like you normally have in a book for your coffee table or something. I mostly like the ones who are like really homey and just not too beautified.
Yep. They're human. Well, in the meantime, we'll direct them to your Instagram.
Tussen kunst en quarantaine.
Okay. And also you can go to herenow.org to see some of the pictures. We'll hook you up. Anneloos Officiers in Holland, thank you so much for this respite and this opportunity for everybody. We're working on a Here and Now submission. We'll get it to you.
Oh, I would love that. Thank you so much. Really nice to meet you.
Well, just something to make us smile there. And how about we keep going? How about a little more? There are many who terribly don't survive COVID-19, but when they do, you've probably heard some hospitals are using one of the world's oldest medicines to send them out the door, music. Here at St. Luke's in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and at Memorial South Hospital in Hollywood, Florida, the Rocky theme plays over a loudspeaker as patients pass through an honor guard of doctors, nurses, orderlies, housekeepers, administrators. Then there's the Beatles' Here Comes the Sun. It's one of the most popular songs. Mount Sinai Hospital in Queens, New York, is one of many that uses it.
I love it. I love it. And I actually will often chuckle to myself when I hear it on the loudspeaker because I'll see other colleagues who will start dancing and I've never seen them dance before in my life.
Eric Bludinger is an ER doctor at Mount Sinai. And then there's that anthem from the 80s. Okay, everybody sing.
Don't stop believing. Hold on to that feeling.
Journey's Don't Stop Believing, a huge choice for hospitals who want their patients to keep the faith. But in Detroit, that means even more. Patrick Irwin is with the city's Henry Ford Hospital. He's the Vice President of Human Services, a proud Detroit native. It was his idea to use this song. He joins us now. Patrick, why did you want to use this?
Well, I'm actually that person, the city boy born and raised in South Detroit. I grew up in Southwest Detroit, and so it has a double meaning. This song goes way back. Came out in 1981, and Detroit was in pretty hard times when that came out, and we weren't stopping believing back then, and we're not stopping now. And so we need something that would resonate with our team members and our patients that really captured who and what we are. You can't go to a sporting event or to anything in this area where that song doesn't come up. And even if you're not a Journey fan, that's a line everybody takes to heart. And so things are difficult, and we use this song to pick everybody's spirit up and say, don't stop believing. There are better times in front of us, and it was just a shot in the arm that we needed.
You mentioned the reference to South Detroit, but I'm wondering, too, how this feels to hear this song, because it is such an anthem, and you don't have any sports games or anywhere else where it's probably playing right now.
We really don't see that happening anytime soon. But there's other things that we can focus on. And to be honest, it really is building a better community. It's not always coming easy right now, but there's the old saying, are you your brother and sister's keeper? And our answer to that right now is, yes, we are.
Hmm. Oh, what's it like when you watch a patient go down that tunnel? You know, on either side are hospital workers and they're hearing this song. What's that like?
This hit like a storm. And those very early days, it was terrifying. And people weren't getting released. And it was a trail of tears. But this is not a city that takes a punch and lays down. We punch back. Mm. That's what makes Detroit so special. We just don't get knocked down. And so I'll tell you, when you see the patients walking through that tunnel, you really feel like you've contributed back to humanity. There's a quiet pride, but there's also a more boisterous, we won, and every single person is a victory. It's very emotional.
That's Patrick Irwin, Vice President of Human Resources at Henry Ford Health System. The song they salute recovering patients with is Journey's Don't Stop Believin'. Patrick, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
And my message to everybody else is, don't stop believing. Keep the faith. Faith in yourself, your fellow human beings, this country, and the world. We're good, and we're getting better.
And we'll have some of the videos of these grand exits from hospitals at hereandnow.org.
Mother's Day is this Sunday, which is a huge day of the year for flower shops. Usually, anyway. Many flower shops across the country remain closed because some states don't consider them essential businesses. But some florists in Hawaii have been allowed to reopen in time for the holiday as long as employees and customers can interact in a safe way. Joining us now is Monty Pereira, who is general manager of Watanabe Floral in Honolulu. Monty, welcome.
Hi, great to be here, and aloha from Hawaii.
Aloha to you too. Thank you so much. Now, this is usually a big time of year for you and all florists. How is your business looking at this point?
Well, you know, it's looking a little bit better this week than it was a couple of weeks ago when we were completely shut down. We did get the okay to do contactless delivery starting this week, and we do plan to open our showroom again. But May is the biggest month of the year for a flower shop. For us, it's about 50% bigger than any other month in the year. So we were staring at a big zero, and that was very frightening. But at least we're going to be at about, we're hoping to get to around 50% of a normal Mother's Day.
50%. Now, it's one thing for you to be open up. Do you think that people are going to feel comfortable coming in, taking a look at the flowers, buying them, that kind of thing?
That's a great question. We kind of don't know what to expect. So we've taken some precautions to make sure that our building is ready. We're actually bringing in police officers to make sure in case there's a crowd outside that that can be managed safely. I can tell you that once we got the okay to do contactless delivery here in Hawaii, and we turned on our website because that's the only way people could order based on the safety precautions, we sold out our 1,600 delivery slots in 72 hours. And that had never happened before in such a quick amount of time. So there sure seems to be a pent-up demand this Mother's Day.
How many workers have you had to lay off during this crisis, and have you been able to bring any of them back?
That was the hardest part. I mean, we have 80 to 85 full-time equivalent team members. And when this happened, when we were forced to shut down back in March the 23rd, we had to furlough almost all of them. You know, we were able to keep 10 on that had to do some administrative tasks. And we had one segment of our business, which is supplying flowers to Sam's Club and Walmart and Target, that had to remain open on a limited basis. So, you know, I would say 80% of our team were furloughed. And it's such a blessing to be able to see them trickling back last week. And as of this week, we're going to be... not only are we bringing back all of our team, but we have to bring in additional people to help with the delivery. So we'll be around 100 strong this week, which is wonderful.
Were you able to get federal loans?
We were one of the fortunate ones. We were when the clock struck midnight on day one, we had our application in. So we were able to get some PPP financing, which is such a blessing. I mean, without that, it would have been a real, real bleak situation. So that's going to help us to buy some time and until we were open. And now that we're open, we're hoping to be able to sustain ourselves going forward until, you know, this kind of goes away a little bit more.
Now, I don't know how it works in Hawaii, but in a lot of the rest of the country, the flowers have to be flown in from all over the world, or at least all over the hemisphere. Are you able to get what you need, or how's the supply chain going?
You know, they always say it's easier to shut down than it is to ramp back up. And we're certainly seeing that. The problem that we're having now, it's trying to get more product in has been a challenge, you know, because you're right. Even in Hawaii, most of the floral product in Hawaii is originating in South America, whether it's directly from South America or via Miami or Los Angeles to Hawaii. So it takes a 2-week period to ramp up. And we're struggling with that, you know, to be able to fully ramp up. Product is available. It's getting the lift and getting it here to Hawaii because we have a quarantine in place. So no airlines is wanting to fly to Hawaii because no passengers can come. So getting the cargo to fly it to Hawaii has been a challenge.
Finally, let me just ask you in general, is life getting back to normal in Hawaii overall, or do you think that it is about the same as it is on the mainland right now?
You know what? I think in Hawaii, I think we're a little bit different. And I think one of the biggest reasons for that is that it is starting to get back to a little bit of normalcy in terms of a few more retail shops like a florist are able to operate a little bit. But in Hawaii, we are so dependent on tourism. And that's still completely shut down. And we went in early March, the state of Hawaii went in early March from the lowest unemployment rate in the nation at under 2%. And 2 weeks later, we're at 40% unemployment when we had to shut down tourism. So until that reopens, life in Hawaii is going to be a real, real challenge.
That is Monty Pereira, who's general manager of Watanabe Floral in Honolulu. Monty, thank you so much.
I appreciate the time. Have a great day. Happy Mother's Day.
And you are listening here to one of Monty's favorite songs about flowers, Le Pikake, by the Hawaii-based duo Hapa. By the way, Robin, Hawaii has kept its case numbers and mortality from COVID down, of course, helped by the fact that it's an island in the middle of the Pacific. The only U.S. jurisdiction with no cases is American Samoa. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now. Hey.